away over the crystalline night from Times Square, then a blast of fireworks in the street.
"Happy 1999, my love," Lotto said to Mathilde, and it had been so very long since they had kissed like this. A month at least. He had forgotten about the freckles on her pretty nose. How had he forgotten such a thing? Nothing like having a wife who worked herself to death to stifle the mood for love. Nothing like dying dreams, he thought, and disappointment. Mathilde's irises shifted smaller when she pulled her head back.
"This will be your breakthrough year," she said. "You'll be Hamlet on Broadway. You'll find your groove."
"I love your optimism," he said, but felt sick. Elizabeth and Rachel were both kissing Susanna's cheeks because she looked so lonely. Samuel kissed her also, blushing, but she laughed him off.
"I'm trashed," Danica said, pulling away from her kiss with Charlie. She looked startled.
They left, two by two, and Mathilde turned off the lights, yawned, piled the food and glasses on the counters to clean them up in the morning. Lotto watched as she shimmied off her dress in the bedroom and climbed under the duvet in her thong.
"You remember when we used to have sex before we even went to bed on New Year's Day? A bodily blessing for the new year," he called to her through the doorway.
He considered saying more, that this year, maybe, they could have a kid. Lotto could be the stay-at-home parent. For sure, if he was the one who had the relevant anatomy, a mistake would already have been made with the birth control, and a little Lotto would be even now kicking its heels in his gut. It was unfair that women could have such primordial joy, and men could not.
"Baby, we used to have sex on garbage day and grocery shopping day, too," she said.
"What changed?" he said.
"We're old," she said. "We still do it more than most of our married friends. Twice a week's not bad."
"Not enough," he muttered.
"I heard that," she said. "As if I've ever made myself unavailable to you."
He heaved a sigh, prepared to stand.
"Fine," she said. "If you come to bed now, I'll let you do me. But don't be mad if I fall asleep."
"Glory. How tempting,"
Lotto said, and sat back down with his bottle in the dark. He listened to his wife's breath even into snores and wondered how he had arrived here. Drunk, lonely, stewing in his failure. Triumph had been assured. Somehow, he'd frittered his potential away. A sin. 30 and still a nothing. Kills you slowly, failure. As Sally would have said, he done been bled out. Perhaps we love him more like this. Humbled. Tonight, he understood his mother, burying herself alive in her beach house. No more risking the hurt that came from contact with others. He listened to the dark beat under his thoughts, which he had had forever, since his father had died. Release. A fuselage could fall from a plane and pin him into the earth. One flick of a switch in his brain would power him down. Blessed relief at last, it would be. Aneurysms ran in the family. His father's had been so sudden, 46, too young, and all Lotto wanted was to close his eyes and find his father there. To put his head on his father's chest and smell him and hear the warm thumpings of his heart. Was that so much to ask? He'd had one parent who'd loved him. Mathilde had given him enough, but he'd ground her down. Her hot faith had cooled. She averted her face. She was disappointed in him. Oh, man, he was losing her, and if he lost her, if she left him, the leather valise in her hand, her thin back unturning. He might as well be dead. Lotto was weeping. He could tell from the cold on his face. He tried to keep quiet. Mathilde needed sleep. She had been working 16-hour days, 6 days a week, kept them fed and housed. He brought nothing to their marriage, only disappointment and dirty laundry. He fished out the laptop he'd stored under the couch when Mathilde had ordered him to clean up before everyone had come over tonight. He just wanted the internet, the other sad souls of the world. But instead, he opened a blank document, shut his eyes, thought of what he'd lost. Home state, mother, that light he'd once lit in strangers, in his wife, his father. Everyone had underestimated Gawain because he was quiet and unlettered, but only he had understood the value of the water under the scrubby family land, had captured and sold it. Lotto thought of the photos of his mother when she was young, once a mermaid. The tail rolled like a stocking over her legs, undulating in the cold springs. He remembered his own small hand immersed in the source, the bones freezing past the point of numbness. How he'd loved that pain. Pain. Swords of morning light in his eyes. Mathilde was haloed blindingly in the icicles in the window. She was in her slattern's robe. Her feet were red at the knuckles with cold. And her face, what was it? There was something wrong. Eyes puffed and red. What had Lotto done? Surely something awful. Maybe he'd left porn on his laptop, and she'd seen it when she had woken up. Maybe a terrible kind of porn, the worst. Maybe he'd been led into it by wild curiosity, clicking through wormholes so progressively more evil that he ended up at the unforgivable. She would leave him. He'd be finished. Fat and alone and a failure, not even worth the air he'd breathe. "Don't leave me," he said. "I'll be better." She looked up, then stood and came across the rug to the couch and put the computer down on the coffee table and took his cheeks in her cold hands. Her robe parted, revealing her thighs, like sweet pink putti, practically bearing wings.
"Oh, Lotto,"
Mathilde said, and her coffee breath mingled with his own dead muskrat breath, and he felt the swoop of her eyelashes on his temple.
"Baby, you've done it," she said.
"What?" he said.
"It's so good. I don't know why I was so surprised. Of course you're brilliant. It's just been a struggle for so long."
"Thank you," he said. "I'm sorry, what's happening?"
"I don't know. A play, I think. Called The Springs. You started it at 1:47 last night. I can't freaking believe you wrote all that in 5 hours. It needs a third act, some editing. I've already started. You can't spell, but we knew that."
It snapped back to him, his writing last night. Some deep-buried acorn of emotion, something about his father. Oh.
"All along," she said, "hiding here in plain sight. Your true talent."
She had straddled him, was easing his jeans down his hips.
"My true talent," he said slowly, "was hiding."
"Your genius, your new life," she said. "You were meant to be a playwright, my love. Thank fucking God we figured that out."
"We figured that out," he said. As if stepping out of a fog, a little boy, a grown man.
Characters who were him, but also not. Lotto transformed by the omniscient view. A shock of energy as he looked on them in the morning. There was life in these figures. He was suddenly hungry to return to that world, to live in it for a while longer. But his wife was saying,
"Hello there, Sir Lancelot. You doughty fellow. Come out and joust."
And what a beautiful way to fully awaken, his wife astraddle, whispering to his newly knighted peen, warming him with her breath, telling him he's a what? A genius. Lotto had long known it in his bones, since he was a tiny boy shouting on a chair, making grown men grow pink and weep. But how nice to get such confirmation. And in such a format, too. under the golden ceiling, under the golden wife. All right, then. He could be a playwright. He watched as the Lotto he thought he had been stood up in his grease paint and jerkin, his doublet sweated through, panting, the roar inside him going external as the audience rose in ovation. Ghostly out of his body he went, giving an elaborate bow, passing for good through the closed door of the apartment. There should have been nothing left, and yet some kind of Lotto remained, a separate him, a new one, below his wife, who was sliding her face up his stomach, pushing the string of her thong to one side, enveloping him. His hands were opening her robe to show her breasts like nestlings, her chin tipped up toward their vaguely reflected bodies. She was saying,
"Oh, God!"
Her fists coming down hard on his chest, saying,
"Now you're Lancelot. No more Lotto. Lotto's a child's name, and you're no child. You're a genius fucking playwright, Lancelot Satterwhite. We will make this happen."
If it meant his wife smiling through her blonde lashes at him again, his wife posting atop him like a prize equestrienne, he could change. He could become what she wanted. No longer failed actor. Potential playwright. There rose a feeling in him as if he'd discovered a window in a lightless closet locked behind him. And still a sort of pain. A loss. He closed his eyes against it and moved in the dark toward what, just now, only Mathilde could see so clearly.
4. The Springs, 1999. He was still drunk.
"Best night of my life," he said. "A million curtain calls, all my friends. And look at you, gorgeous. Ovations, off-Broadway, bar, walk home, stars in the sky."
"Words are failing you, my love," Mathilde said. Wrong. Words, tonight, had not failed. Unseen in the corners of the theaters, the forces of judgment had gathered. They watched, considered, found it good.
"Body taking over now," he said, and she was game for what he had in mind. But when she returned from the bathroom, he was asleep, naked atop the duvet, and she covered him, kissed his eyelids, tasted his glory there, savored it, slept.
One-Eyed King, 2000.
"Baby, this play is about Erasmus. You can't name it the O'Neroy."
"Why?" Lotto said. "It's a good name."
"Nobody's going to remember it. Nobody knows what it means. I don't know what it means."
"The O'Neroy are the sons of Nyx, Night. Their dreams, brothers of Hypnos, Thanatos, Geras. Sleep, death, old age. This is a play about Erasmus's dreams, baby. Prince of the humanists. The bastard of a Catholic priest, orphaned by the plague in 1483. Desperately in love with another man.
I read the play, I know this already.
And the word O'Neroy makes me laugh. Erasmus was the man who said, in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. One-eyed king. Roi d'un oeil. O'Neroy."
"Oh," she said. She'd frowned when he'd spoken French. She'd been a French, art history, and classics triple major in college. Dark purple dahlia in the garden side window, gleam of autumn light beyond. She came over to him, rested her chin on his shoulder, put her hands down his pants.
"Well, it's a sexy play," she said.
"Yes," he said. "Your hands are very soft, my wife."
"I'm just shaking hands with your one-eyed king."
"Oh, love," he said. "You're brilliant. That is a better title."
"I know," she said. "You may have it."
"Generous," he said.
"Except that I don't like the way your king there is looking at me. He's giving me the evil one eye."
"Off with his head," he said, and carried her into the bedroom. Islands,
2001.
It's not that I agree with them, she said, but it was pretty ballsy of you to write about three Caribbean hotel maids in the middle of a Boston snowstorm.
He didn't pick his head up from the crook of his elbow. Newspapers were strewn around the living room of the new second-floor apartment they'd bought. They were still too house-poor to afford a rug. The austere way the oak floors gleamed reminded him of her.
Phoebe Delmar, I get, he said. She hates everything I have done and will ever do. Cultural appropriation, whatever, strident, shrill. But why did the Times reviewer have to bring up my mother's money? What does that have to do with anything? I sure as stinkers can't afford the heat now, so why do they care? And why can't I write about poor people if I was raised with money? Don't they understand what fiction is?
We can afford heat, she said. Cable, maybe not. But other than that, it's a good review.
It's mixed, he groaned. I feel like dying.
In a week, planes would crash a mile away, and Mathilde at work would drop her cup on the floor, shattering it, and Lotto at home would put on his running shoes and run 43 blocks north to her office and into the revolving door, only to see her leaving in the parallel glass compartment. They would gaze at each other palely through the glass, as she was now outside and he in, and he'd feel a confused shame within his panic, though its source, this very moment, with the intensity of his tiny despair, would already have been forgotten.
"You're such a drama whore," she said. "Phoebe Delmar would win if you died. Just write a new one."
"About what?" he said. "I'm dried up. Done at the age of 33.
"Go back to what you know," she said.
"I don't know anything," he said.
"You know me," she said.
He looked at her, his face smeary with newsprint, and began to smile.
"I do," he said.
The House in the Grove, 2003. Act 2, Scene 1. The porch of the plantation house. Olivia, in tennis whites, waiting for Joseph to come out. Joseph's mother is in a rocking chair with a glass of white wine spritzer in her hand. Ladybird.
"Now come on over here and set yourself down. I'm glad we get a minute to chat. Rare Joseph brings a girlfriend home, you know. Most Thanksgivings it's just us, family. But why don't you tell me about you, darling? Where do you come from? What do your parents do?"
Olivia.
"Nowhere and nothing. I don't have any parents, Mrs. Dutton."
Ladybird.
"Nonsense. Everybody's got parents. You sprung out of somebody's head? I am sorry, but Minerva, you are not. Now, you may not like your parents. The good Lord knows I do not like mine, but you have them for sure."
Olivia.
"I'm an orphan."
Ladybird.
"Orphan? Nobody wanted to adopt you? Beauty like you? I do not believe this. Of course, you must have been a sullen girl." "Oh, yes. I can see you were quite a sullen girl. Difficult. Too smart for your own good."
Olivia, after a long pause.
"Joseph's taking a really long time."
Ladybird.
"Boy's vain. Staring in the mirror, making faces, looking at his pretty hairdo."
They both laugh.
"In any event, you clearly do not want to talk about it, which I do not blame you for. Sore wound, I'm sure it is, darling. Family being the most important thing in the world. The most important. Why, it's your family that tells you who you are. Without a family, you're a nobody."
Olivia, startled, raises her eyes. Ladybird is looking at her, smiling broadly. Olivia.
"I'm not a nobody."
Ladybird.
"Darling, I don't wish to offend, but I have come to doubt that very much. You're pretty, sure, but you don't have much to offer a boy like Joey. And yes, he's in love, but he's a lover. You don't have to worry about him having a broken heart. He'll have a new girl in minutes. You can just skedaddle. Save us both some time. Let him find someone a little more apropos."
Olivia,
slowly. Apropos. You mean a girl with a rich family? That's funny because, Mrs. Dutton, I have a family. They're rich as kings.
Ladybird.
You a liar? Because you are either lying now or you were lying when you said you were an orphan. Either way, I haven't believed a word out of your mouth since you got here.
Joseph comes out, smiling brightly, whistling.
Hello, beauties.
Olivia.
I never lie, Mrs. Dutton. I'm a pathological truth-teller. Now, if you'll excuse me, I'm off to play some tennis with my little hubby here.
Grins. Joseph.
Olivia.
Ladybird, standing.
Your what? Your hubby? Hubby? Husband? Joseph!
Cuts a little close to the quick, Mathilde said, looking up. She wore sadness at the corners of her mouth.
You'll meet my mother someday, Lotto said. Just want you to be prepared. She still asks when I'm going to settle down with a nice girl.
Ouch, Mathilde said. She looked at him over the table, coffee and bagel half-eaten.
Pathological truth-teller?
He looked at her, waited.
Okay,
she conceded. Gacy, 2003.
What would possess the young playwright Lancelot Satterwhite, whose only real talents thus far have shown themselves to be a kind of wild reimagining of the Southern experience, to write a play glorifying John Wayne Gacy, the pedophile serial-murdering clown? As if the wooden dialogue, the awful a cappella songs Gacy sings, and the graphic scenes of murder and mayhem weren't bad enough, the audience leaves after 3 hours with an overwhelming question. Why? Not only extremely bad, this play is in extremely bad taste. Perhaps this is a nod to Satterwhite's betters, or some sort of homage to Sweeney Todd, but, sad to say, Lancelot Satterwhite is no Stephen Sondheim, and he never will be.
Mathilde read. She tossed the newspaper down.
You guessed it. Phoebe fucking Delmar, she said.
All the rest of them loved it, he said. Normally I feel some sort of shame with a bad review, but this chick is so off base I don't even care.
I think the play is funny, Mathilde said.
It is funny, Lotto said.
The whole audience was cracking up. Phoebe Delmar. 5 plays, 5 pans. The woman knows nothing, Mathilde said.
They looked at each other, started to smile. Write another, he said. I know. Grimoire, 2005.
You're a genius, she said, putting the manuscript down.
So do me, he said.
Gladly, she said.
Hamlin in Winter, 2006. Sally, Rachel, and Rachel's new husband came up for the opening night.
Husband? A man? Where was Elizabeth?
Mathilde and Lotto held hands in the taxi going to brunch, communicating, not speaking. The husband chitter-chattered like a squirrel.
Affable dimwit,
was Mathilde's assessment later.
Illiterate snake, was Lotto's.
What is she doing? I thought she was a lesbian. I loved Elizabeth. Elizabeth had gorgeous breasts. Where did she pick this meth head up?
Just because he has a tattoo on his neck doesn't mean he's a meth head, Mathilde said.
She thought for a moment.
I think.
They had the story over Eggs Benedict. Rachel had had a bad year after college. She had so much energy, her hands darted like hummingbirds from plate to utensil to glass to hair to lap, without cease.
You don't get married at 23 because you had a bad year, Lotto said.
Why do you get married at 23, Lotto?
Rachel said.
Pray tell.
Touché, Mathilde murmured.
Lotto looked at her.
Actually, we were 22, she said.
Anyway, as she had said, Rachel had had a bad year. Elizabeth broke up with her because of something Rachel had done. Whatever it was bad enough that Rachel flushed a brighter red, and the husband squeezed her knee under the table. She came home to the beach so Sally could take care of her. Pete here worked at Marineland.
"Are you a scientist, Pete?" Mathilde said.
"No, but I feed the dolphins," he said. Pete was exactly right at exactly the right time, Rachel said. Oh, and she was going to law school, and if Lotto didn't mind, she'd take over the trust when she was done.
"Did Mother cut you off, too?" Lotto said.
Poor lady.
Denied the huge frothy celebration she'd so longed for. She wouldn't have known who to invite and wouldn't have attended anyway, but she would have delighted in planning. Mutton chop sleeves for you, Rachel. A cake like Chichen Itza. Flower girls in hoop skirts. Her whole Yankee family getting sunburnt and internally combusting with envy. I wouldn't be surprised if she changed the beneficiary of the trust to a schizoid pit bull rescue or something.
There was a pause. Sally winced and busied herself with her napkin.
"She didn't cut me off," Rachel said quietly.
A long silence. Lotto blinked the sting away.
"But I had to sign a prenup. I only get 2 mil, Pete said, making a comically sad face, and they all looked down into their Bloody Marys, and he blushed and said, "I meant if something bad happens. Nothing's happening, baby." And Rachel gave a tiny nod.
He would prove a temporary embarrassment. In 6 months, Elizabeth, of the great soft boobs, the cat's eye glasses, the pale hair and skin, would be back for good. At the theater, Lotto watched his aunt and sister. 10 minutes in, when their mascara started running, he sighed and relaxed and passed a hand over his face. After all the curtain calls and congratulations and hugs and the speech he gave to his actors, who loved him, it was plain from the way they looked at him, Mathilde at last snuck Lotto out the back door to the bar where she'd had the assistant take his family. Sally leapt up, burst into tears, hung on his neck. Rachel hugged him fiercely around the waist. Pete darted in here and there to pat Lotto on his arms. Sally said in his ear,
"I had no idea, my sweet, how much you wanted babies."
He looked at her, surprised.
"That is what you got from this? That I want kids?"
"Well, yeah," Rachel said. "The play is all about family, how you pass things down from one generation to another, how when you're born you belong to a certain patch of family land. It was just obvious. Plus, Dorothy is pregnant, and Julie has a baby upstairs, and even Hoover carries his baby around on his chest. That's not what you meant?"
"Nope," Mathilde said, laughing.
Lotto shrugged. "Maybe," he said. Eleanor of Aquitaine, 2006. A small man came rushing into the black box at the VIP reception. His sparse hair was white. He wore a faded green cloak and looked, flapping up, like a Luna moth.
"Oh, my dear boy! Oh, my dear, dear Lotto, you have done it! You've done what I always knew you would do! You have it in your blood, the theater! Tonight, Talia kisses your cheeks!"
Lancelot smiled at the little man aping Talia, kissing his cheeks. He took a glass of champagne from a passing tray.
"Thank you so very much. I love Eleanor of Aquitaine. She was a genius, the mother of modern poetry. Now, forgive me, I know that we know each other, but tell me how exactly?"
Lotto smiled, never taking his eyes off the little man, who drew his head back quickly and blinked.
"Oh, dear boy, I apologize. I have followed your career, you see, with such delight, and knew you so well through your plays that I thought, of course, you knew me in return. The old authorial fallacy. I'm mortified. I'm your old teacher at prep school. Denton Thrasher. Does that ring a..."
He took a breath, let it out theatrically.
"Does that ring a bell?"
"I'm so sorry, Mr. Thrasher," Lancelot said. "I don't recall. Losing my memory. But thank you ever so much for coming back here and reminding me."
He smiled down at the little man.
"You don't..."
the man said, his voice faltering. Then he blushed and seemed to fade where he stood. Mathilde,
who had been at her husband's side this whole time, wondered. His memory was as sharp as a diamond cutter. He never forgot a face. He could act out a play verbatim, having seen it only twice. She watched him turn and meet a legendary musical star with a kiss on her hand and saw, past the charm and the easy laughter, a prickly energy. Denton Thrasher walked away. She put a hand on her husband's arm. When the musical star moved on, Lotto turned to her and silently docked his head on her shoulder for 2 moments. Recharged, he turned to face the others. Walls, Ceiling, Floor, 2008.
Walls, ceiling, floor? The producer said.
He was a gentle, sleepy-eyed man who hid a ferocious heart in the flesh of his chest.
First part of a trilogy of The Dispossessed, Lotto said. Same family, different main characters. They lose the family house. It's where they store everything. History, furniture, ghosts, a tragedy. All three would, we hope, play concurrently.
Concurrently? Christ. Ambitious, the producer said. Which part of the trilogy is this?
The mental health part, Lotto said. Last Sip, 2008.
Last Sip, let me guess, the producer said. Alcoholism.
Foreclosure, Lotto said. And the last, Grace, is the story of an Afghanistan veteran who comes home. Grace, 2008.
A war story called Grace? The producer said.
I embedded with the Marine Corps in Afghanistan, Lotto said. 2 weeks, but every moment I thought I was about to die. And every moment I didn't, I felt blessed. Even if I left religion as a kid. Believe it or not, the title fits.
You're killing me.
The producer closed his eyes. When he opened them, he said,
Fine. If I read them and love them, we'll do it. I'm Bats for the Springs, and Grimoire. I think you have something interesting in your brain.
Deal,
Mathilde said from the kitchen, arranging fresh-baked speculoos on a plate.
But only off-off-Broadway, he said. Maybe in New Jersey somewhere.
For the first run, Mathilde said, setting the tray of cookies and tea on the table.
The producer laughed, but nobody else did.
You're serious, he said.
Read it. You'll see, Mathilde said.
1 week later, the producer called. Mathilde answered the phone.
I see, the producer said.
I thought you would, Mathilde said. Most people eventually do.
Did you? The producer said.
He's so clownish on the surface. All joke and dazzle. How in the world could you have seen it?
But I did.
The moment I met him, she said. A fucking supernova. Every day since.
She thought, but did not say, almost. After she hung up with the producer, she came to Lotto over the veranda of their new house in the country. Still a disaster of siding and drywall, but she had known there was something beautiful. Fieldstone, ancient beams, under the mess. There was a cherry orchard in the front, a perfect flat space for a pool in the back. She had quit her job months ago, had taken over the business side of his. They kept the one bedroom as a pied-à-terre in the city. She would make this house perfect for them. Life was rich with possibility. Or life was possibly rich. Soon, perhaps, she wouldn't have to worry about phone bills, juggling this credit card to pay off the next. She felt incandescent with the news. Cold sun, Jack in the Pulpit's nosing out of the still frozen mud. Lotto lay watching the world incrementally wake up. They had been married for 17 years. She lived in the deepest room in his heart. And sometimes that meant that wife occurred to him before Mathilde, helpmeet before herself. Abstraction of her, before the visceral being. But not now. When she came across the veranda, he saw Mathilde all of a sudden, the dark whip at the center of her. How
so gently, she flicked it and kept him spinning. She put her cold hand on his stomach, which he was sunning to banish the winter's white. "Vain," she said.
"An actor in a playwright's hide," he said sadly. "I'll never not be vain."
"Oh, well, it's you," she said. "You're desperate for the love of strangers, to be seen."
"You see me," he said, and he heard the echo with his thoughts a minute before and was pleased.
"I do," she said.
"Now, please, talk," he said. She stretched her long arms over her head, and there were little nests of winter hair in the pits. She could hatch baby robins in those things. She looked at him, savoring her own knowing, his unknowing. She put her arms down with a sigh and said,
"Do you want to hear?"
And he said, "Oh my goodness, Em, you are absolutely killing me." And she said,
"It's a go. All three."
And he laughed and took her hand, calloused from house demolition, and kissed it, bitten fingernail to bitten finger, up the arm, the neck. Hefted her over his shoulder and pinwheeled her until the ground heaved, and then, because the air was bright and the birds were watching, he kissed a long trail down her stomach, and he shucked her right there. 5. After the incomprehension and the raw fish came the long flight, then the short. At last, home. He sat, watching through the window as the staircase approached the plane over the sun-shot asphalt. Spring rain had blown through as they taxied in and just as swiftly was gone. He wanted his face in Mathilde's neck, the soothe of her hair. 2 weeks as playwright in residence in Osaka, and as long as he'd ever been away from his wife. Too much. He'd woken up to the absence of Mathilde in his bed and felt grief in the coolness where her heat should have been. The rolling staircase fumbled and missed the door 3 times before it clicked in, eager as a virgin. How lovely to stretch this long body of his, to stand and breathe for a few moments at the top of the stairs, savoring the oil and manure and ozone smell of the little Albany airport, sun on his cheeks, wife inside the building waiting to take him to the pretty house in the country, his early dinner. The luxuriant fatigue in his bones chased by cold Prosecco, then hot shower, then smooth Mathilde skin, then sleep. His happiness stretched out its wings and gave a few flaps. He hadn't accounted for the other passengers' impatience. It wasn't until he was already mid-air that he felt the hand hard in the middle of his back. How outrageous, he thought. Pushed. Now the pavement was billowing up toward him like a flicked tablecloth. One distant windsock tonguing eastward, the crenellated roof of the airport building, a shine of the sandpapery steps in the sunlight, the plane's nose somehow peeling into his vision, and a pilot stretching his arms in the window. And Lancelot had twisted entirely around by the time his right shoulder hit the edge of a stair, and he was looking at his ostensible pusher looming out of the dark cave mouth at the top, a man with tomato-colored hair and face, lines embossed on his forehead, wearing Madras shorts, of all ugly things. Lancelot's head hit the tread at the moment his rear and legs did, if somewhat lower, and things got a bit swimmy now, and behind the man was the flight attendant who'd snuck Lancelot 2 mini bottles of bourbon after he'd spent a few minutes exercising his old actor's charm on her. Brief fantasy of her with skirt up, legs around his waist in the plastic bathroom, before he banished the image. He was married and faithful. And she was in the process of putting her hands slowly up to her mouth as his body made a satisfying thunkada-thunkada rhythm in sliding downward, and he kicked out toward the rail with the instinct to stop his fall, but felt a curious sharp clicking in the shin region, and all in that general direction went numb. With delicious slowness, he came to rest in a shallow puddle, his shoulder and ear seeping up the sun-warmed water, his legs still extended up the stairs, though his foot, it appeared, canted outward in a manner unbefitting its owner's dignity. Down, now, the tomato-headed man was coming, a moving stop sign. His footsteps rocked some locus of pain in Lancelot. When the man was close, Lancelot held up the hand that wasn't numb, but the man stepped over him. Lancelot got a flash up the tube of his shorts, hairy white thigh, dark genital tangle. Then the man was running over the shining asphalt, swallowed up by the slab of a terminal door. Pushed? Fled? Who would do such a thing? Why? Why to him? What had he done? There'd be no answers. The man was gone. The flight attendant's face came into view, soft cheeks and hoarse nostrils blowing, and he closed his eyes as she touched his neck, and someone somewhere began to shout. Backlit, the fracture was tectonic, the plates of him overlapping. He was given two casts, a sling, a crown of gauze, pills that made his body feel as if it were encased in 3 inches of rubber. As if, had he been on the same drugs when he fell, he would have hit asphalt only to bounce delightedly high, startling pigeons midair, and coming to rest on the airport roof. He sang falsetto to earth, wind, and fire all the way to the city. Mathilde let him eat 2 donuts, and his eyes filled with tears, because they were the most amazing donuts in the history of glazed donuts, food of the gods. He was full of joy. They would have to spend the summer in the country. Alas. His walls, ceiling, floor was in rehearsal, and he should be there for it. But really, there was so little he could do. He couldn't climb the stairs to the rehearsal space, and it would be an abuse of power to make his dramaturge carry him. He couldn't even climb the stairs to their tiny apartment. He sat on the building staircase, looking at the pretty black and white tiles. Back and forth Mathilde went, gathering the food, the clothes, everything they needed from the apartment on the second floor, down to the car double-parked in the street. The building manager's child stuck her shy brown head out the door and looked at him.
"What ho, Spratling?"
he said to the kid. She stuck a finger in her mouth and took it out all wet.
"What is that nutty Bobo doing out there on the stairs?"
she said, tiny echo of some adult. Lancelot brayed, and the building manager peered out, a bit more ruddy than normal, and took a look at the casts, sling, crown. He nodded at Lancelot, then pulled his kid and head inside, and shut the door fast. In the car, Lancelot marveled at Mathilde. What a smooth face she had. Lickable, like a vanilla ice cream cone. If only the left side of his body hadn't suddenly become buried in concrete, he would leap over the emergency brake and treat her the way a cow treats a block of salt. "Kids are jerks," he said. "Bless their hearts. We should have some, Em. Maybe now that you're my nurse for the rest of the summer, you can have free license with my body, and in all the lust and frenzy, we'll beget a sweet wee thing." They weren't using birth control, and there was no question that either one of them was defective. It was clearly a matter of luck and time. When he wasn't high, he was more careful, kept quiet, sensitive to the stoic longing he'd felt in her whenever he brought it up.
"Those drugs of yours spectacular?" she said. "They seem pretty spectacular."
"It's time," he said. "It's more than time. We've got some cash now, a house. You're ripe still. Your eggs may be getting a little wrinkly, I don't know. 40. We're risking some springs going sprawling in the kid's head. Though it may not be so bad to have a dumb kid. Smart ones are off as soon as they're able to escape. Dumbos stick around longer. On the other hand, if we wait too long, we'll be cutting his pizza for him until we're 93. No, we got to do this thing ASAP. As soon as we get home, I'm going to impregnate the heck out of you."
"Most romantic thing you've ever said to me," she said.
Down the dirt road, up the gravel drive. Graceful, dripping limbs of cherry trees. Oh, gosh, they lived in the cherry orchard. He stood at the back door, watching Mathilde open the French door to the veranda, go down the grass to the new and sparkling pool. There were 2 tanned and muscled men gleaming in the last sun, unrolling a strip of sod. Mathilde in her white dress, her cropped platinum hair, her slim body, the sunburst sky, the shining muscle men.
It was unbearable. Tableau vivant. He sat suddenly. A hot dampness overcame his eyes. All this beauty, the stun of his luck. Also, the pain that had just surfaced. A nuclear submarine out of the deep. He woke at his usual time, 5:26, drifting from a dream in which he was in a bathtub barely bigger than his body, and it was full of tapioca pudding. Scrabble as he might, he couldn't get out of it. The pain made him nauseated, and his groaning woke Mathilde. She hovered over him with her terrible breath, her hair tickling his cheek. When she came back with a tray of scrambled eggs and a bagel with cream cheese and scallions and black coffee and a rose in a vase with dew all over it, he saw the excitement in her face. "You prefer me as an invalid," he said. "For the first time in our lives together," she said, "you're neither a black suck of depression nor a swirl of manic energy. It's nice. Maybe we can even watch an entire movie together now that you're stuck with me." "Maybe," she said breathlessly, reddening. Poor Mathilde. "We could collaborate on a novel or something." He tried to smile, but overnight the world had turned. And her translucence today seemed anemic, no longer confected of sugar and clarified butter. The eggs were greasy, the coffee overstrong, and even the rose from his wife's garden emitted an odor that cloyed and put him off. "Or not," she said. "It was just an idea."
"Sorry, my love," he said. "I seem to have lost my appetite."
She kissed him on the forehead, then rested her cool cheek on it. "You're hot. I'll get you one of your magical pills," she said, and he had to hold his impatience in as she fumbled for the water, the cap of the bottle, the cotton, the tablet that gloriously dissolved on his tongue. She came out to the hammock where he was contemplating darkly, though the sun shimmied and played in the bright leaves and the pool suckled at its gutters. 3 glasses into a bottle of bourbon. It was past 4. Who cared? He had nowhere to be. He had nothing to do. He was deeply depressed, fracking depressed, deep shale shattered. He had put on Pergolesi's Stabat Mater, and it was blasting out of his special speakers in the dining room, all the way out to him in the hammock. He wanted to call his mother, to let her sweet voice swathe him. But instead he watched a documentary about Krakatoa on his laptop. He was imagining what the world would look like under volcanic ash, as if some mad child had come along and scribbled black and gray over the landscape, the streams gone greasy, the trees powder puffs of ash, greensward a slick of gleaming oil. An image of Hades. Fields of punishment, screams in the night, the asphodel meadows, the dead. Clacketing their bones. Luxuriating in the horror he was, in the unhappiness of being broken. There was not a kind of wallowing joy in this.
"Love," his wife said gently. "I've brought you some iced tea."
"No iced tea," he said. And, surprise, his tongue wasn't working as well as it ought. It was thick. He made as if to look cross-eyed at it. Then said, "Whether the weather be cold, whether the weather be hot, we'll be together, whatever the weather, whether we like it or not."
"Too true," Mathilde said. And now he saw she was wearing her ancient blue skirt, her hippie gear from a million years ago, when they were new to each other and he jumped her bones 4 times a day. She was alluring, still, his wifey. She crawled on the hammock carefully, but the motion still sent a million fangs deep into his broken bones, and he groaned but bit back his shout and could still barely see when she hiked her skirt to her waist and took off her tank top. A fillip of interest down in his always interested fillip. But the pain ground it down again. She cajoled, but to no avail. She gave up.
"You must have broken your peen bone, too," she joked.
It was all he could do to keep himself from flipping her out of the hammock.
A fascinating PBS special on black holes. The suck and draw so strong it can gulp down light. Light. He drank deeply, watching. He kept his own counsel. There were problems at the rehearsal. They needed him, they said. There was a difficult performance of The Springs in Boston, and a reportedly great series of walls, ceiling, floor in St. Louis. He generally went to all that invited him, and yet he couldn't move from this cottage in the middle of cornfields and cows. Lancelot Satterwhite was needed, and Lancelot Satterwhite was not there. He had never not been there. He might as well already be dead. A clip-clop in the library. There was a horse in the house? But no, it was Mathilde in her cycling shoes coming in her silly padded trow. She shined with health and sweat. She stank of armpit and garlic. Baby, Mathilde said, taking his glass away, turning off the show. It's been 2 weeks and you've drunk 4 bottles of Blanton's. No more documentaries on disaster. You need to do something to fill up your time. He sighed, rubbed his face with his good hand. Write something, she commanded.
Not inspired, he said.
Write an essay, she said.
Essays are for chumps, he said.
Write a play about how you hate the world, she said.
I don't hate the world. The world hates me, he said.
Boo-hoo, she laughed. She couldn't know, he thought. Don't punish her. Plays don't just get ground out. You need to be filled with a hot kind of urgency to make it right. He gave her a pained smile and took a sip from the bottle. Are you drinking because you're sad, or are you drinking to show me how sad you are? She said.
Direct hit. He laughed. Viper, he said.
Falstaff, she said. You're even getting fat. All that running for nothing. And I thought we'd banished it for good. Come on, kid, buck up. Stop drinking. Get right in the head.
Easy for you to say, he said. You are in robust good health. You exercise 2 hours a day. I get winded going out to the hammock. So until my benighted bones knit themselves to a semblance of solidity, I shall exercise my right to intoxication and bile and mooning.
How about a 4th of July party? She said.
No, he said.
It wasn't a question, she said. And then, as if by magic, here he was 3 days later among shish kebabs and multicolored sparklers going off in those gorgeous paw-like children's hands as they ran across the acres that Mathilde had cropped herself on her roaring mower. There was nothing that miracle woman couldn't do, he thought. Then thought about how this fresh-cut grass smell was the olfactory scream of the plants. There was a whole keg and corn on the cob and veggie bratwurst and watermelon, and Mathilde in a pale low-cut dress, looking beyond beautiful, nestling her head beneath his chin and kissing him on the neck, so that all night he carried around a red lipstick mark on his throat like a wound. All of his friends swirling around in the dusk, in the night. Cholly with Danica. Susanna like a Roman candle herself in a red dress, and her new girlfriend, Zora, young and black with a tremendously beautiful afro, kissing under the weeping willow. Samuel with his wife and their triplets wobbling around with watermelon rinds in their hands, and Arnie with his newest barback teenager, Xantippe, almost as stunning as Mathilde had been in her heyday, black bob and a yellow dress so short the toddlers could certainly see her thong and dewy loins. Lotto imagined sprawling on the grass to get his own eyeful, but inversion meant tremendous pain, and he remained upright. The fireworks, blister popping in the sky, the party sounds. Doomed people celebrate peace with sky bombs. Lotto watched himself as if from a distance, playing his own stiffly acted role of jocular clown. He had a terrible headache. He went into the bathroom, and the bright lights, the sight of his flushed cheeks and his air splints made him woozy, and he let the smile out of his face,
looked at the drooping mask that remained. Midway on life's journey, he said in a low voice,
Nel mezzo del cammin di nostra vita, mi ritrovai per una selva oscura, che la diritta via era smarrita.
He was ridiculous, lugubrious and pretentious at the same time. Lugentious, protubrious. He poked at the belly the size of a six-month-old baby glued to his midsection. When Charlie had seen him, he'd said,
You okay there, fella? You're looking kind of fat.
Hello, pot, Lancelot had said. You're looking black. Which was true. Charlie's girth strained the buttons of his $400 shirt. But then again, Charlie had never been a beautiful boy. Lancelot had had much farther to fall. Danica, chic in the one-shoulder designer dress that Charlie's money had bought her, said,
Leave him be, Chol. The man's body is broken head to toe. If there's any time in a man's life that he gets to get fat, this is it.
He couldn't bear to go back out there, Lancelot decided, to see those people he was pretty sure at times he hated. He went into their room and undressed as well as he could, and climbed into bed. He was in a murky anteroom of sleep when the door opened, the hall light blasting him awake, then closed, and there was a body in the room that wasn't his. He waited, panicky. He could barely move. If someone crawled into bed with him to ravish him, he couldn't flee. But whoever it was two whoevers, and they had no interest in the bed, because there were some low laughs and some whispers and the shush of fabric, and they began to pound out a rhythm against the bathroom door, a kind of syncopated slap-thump with some surprising percussive ughs. That door was really rattling away, Lancelot thought. He should tighten the knob tomorrow. And then came the thought, a knife of grief in his heart, that once he would have been the one to bring some girl in to do her, and it would have been far, far better than this girl was being done, poor thing, though she seemed to be having a good time. Still, there was something a little fakey about her moaning. Once, even, he would have gotten up and made an orgy out of the event, joining so smoothly it would have been as if he had been invited. Now he lay puddled in his broke bone carapace, critiquing the performance, soft as a hermit crab. Sure of the dark, he made a hermit crab's frowning, whiskered face, snapping claws with his good hand. The girl said,
Ah!
And the guy said, Ugh! And there was more hushed laughing. Oh my God, I needed that, the guy whispered. These parties are such shit shows when people bring their kids.
I know, she said. Poor Lotto watching those babies with that longing on his face. And Mathilde's so skinny these days, she's getting ugly. She keeps letting it go, she's going to be some kind of witchy old hag. Like, I don't know, but Botox exists for a reason.
I was always confused why anyone thought she was hot. She's just tall and blonde and skinny, never pretty, he said. I'm a connoisseur. The sound of flesh slapped. Buttocks, Lotto thought. Thigh.
She's interesting looking. Remember how that was a thing in the early 90s? We were all so jealous. Remember when Lotto and Mathilde had the grandest love story ever? And their parties. Christ. I kind of feel bad for them now.
The door opened. A pumpkin-colored head, balding. Aha. Arnie. Followed out by a bare shoulder, jagged with bones. Danica. Old affair revisited. Poor Charlie. Lotto felt sick that matrimony could seem so cheap to some people. Weary, weary, sick to death. Lancelot stood and dressed again. Those people could rabbit themselves until they died of exhaustion, but he wouldn't let them mealy-mouth Mathilde and him. How appalling to be pitied by such gnats. Adulterer gnats. Worse. He came downstairs again and stood in the door with his wife and said cheery goodbyes to the friends. The children passed out in the parents' arms, the drunk adults being driven, the merely tipsy driving themselves. He spackled so much extra charm onto Arnie and Danica that they both blushed and began flirting shyly back,
Danica hooking her fingers through his belt loop when she kissed him goodnight.
"Alone again,"
Mathilde said, watching the last taillights wink away.